Hello and welcome to the Classicist Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, here with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, I want to turn today to a historical analysis you recently did for American greatness. In response to an interesting prompt, we all know that the slogan attached to Donald Trump's presidential campaign and subsequently to his presidency has been "Make America Great Again." And you set out in this piece to answer the question of whether there were historical antecedents for that, times when a country or an empire looked fated to decline and stopped the slide, thanks at least in part to political leadership. And your answer to that, which leads off the piece, is sometimes. It does happen sometimes. And the first example that you cite is the Emperor Justinian,
well,
the Eastern Roman Empire.
In the early 6th century, most people thought that Byzantium was doomed, just as the Western Empire had fallen a century earlier, because they were pressed on their eastern borders by the Sassanid Persian Empire. The Goths had already overrun most of the West. The Vandals were in North Africa. There were riots. The so-called Nika riots, the first years of Justinian's reign, where the civil bureaucracy was just completely out of control. He married a prostitute, Theodora, and so he was the only emperor, the last emperor, I should say, that spoke Latin. He didn't even speak Greek very well. And yet, the language of the Eastern Empire was Greek. And yet, in the space of about 38 years, he re-established the Justinian Code, as we know today, codified all of Roman law of about 1,000 years. He broke the back of the civil administrative deep state. He expanded the Eastern Empire's borders. He destroyed the Vandal Empire and retook North Africa. He retook Sicily, retook two-thirds of Italy from the Goths, got an inroads in Spain, codified all of the Aegean and what was Greece and the Balkans under Byzantine rule that would last probably for about 500 years. And then, of course, at Constantinople, he gave the Eastern Empire another 1,000 years. And he built Hagia Sophia, the largest cathedral in the world, until the construction of the Vatican. So it was pretty amazing rule. And he did it by creating sort of a traditional religion and stamping out schisms within Eastern Orthodoxy. He was a big builder, like Augustus, the idea that you have to build majestic things so that you can inspire people. And he was very careful with his overseas military operations. He made sure that they were, if anything, understaffed, and enlisted local people so that even though the empire was fighting all the time, there were more contractors or sort of special forces type of engagements. The great general Belisarius and Narses never had really under their command more than 20,000 people on their expeditionary forces. So it was quite an impressive achievement.
Now, in the piece, you jump from Justinian all the way to the 1980s, but you do name check a number of leaders along the way in the intervening years that you also see as fitting this category. So those names, Pericles, Alexander, Augustus, Constantine, Charlemagne, Queen Elizabeth I, Catherine the Great, Joseph II, Lincoln, and Churchill. Obviously too much in there for us to cover, but I wonder, as you look at that small group of names, are there commonalities that stand out, Victor, in terms of the personalities or in terms of the talents or in terms of the context in which they found themselves? Are there leading indicators we can look to as to the kinds of people who end up personifying these roles?
I think so. I think part of it is that they have a historical sense that decline it's not a matter of exhaustion of natural resources, or it's not predicated on enemies over the next hill. It's usually internal, and it's because of psychological malaise, or the idea that the currency is so inflated or so worthless, or the treasury's in such arrears, or there's not enough money, or the defense capabilities are exhausted. But mostly it's a sense that with all these leaders, that it's a state of mind, and that by sheer force of personality, they can reconvince people to go back to first things, the things that made England or Russia or the Byzantines or the Romans great at one point. And so it's kind of a reactionary nostalgia, but it's also the idea that there's certain basic principles. You have to have a balanced budget. You have to have money in the treasury. You can't have a debased currency. You have to have some transparency. Corruption is usually the common enemy. And you have to be very careful how you fight. You have to know who your enemies are. You have to have alliances. And you have to make sure that you know where you want to be when you get into an exhausting war. What was the end game? Where do you want, what strategically do you want to accomplish, and do you have the means to achieve those ends?
Now, one can imagine someone listening to this list of leaders from the past and sort of waving off its applicability to the modern era. There is, after all, this school of thought that it never really goes away, that holds that Western democracy is sort of inherently decadent and that the story is just kind of one long tale of decline. But you point to the most recent example of this kind of turnaround leadership as Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s. It's probably an indicator of their success that it can be easy, especially for those who didn't live through the 70s, to forget the sense of decline around both the US and the UK at that time. So give us a refresher course on the state of those two countries that they inherited and how Reagan and Thatcher worked their will in them.
Yeah, I don't think our present generation remembers that word stagflation, which meant you had high inflation, but you had low economic growth and high unemployment at the same time after the Jimmy Carter years. I can remember farming in those years and going in and asking for an ag loan and being very happy I got one at 15% interest rates, or buying sulfur bags that had three different prices scratched out as the local ag supply kept adding, you know, 30, 40 cents to bag as they sat there for 3 months because of the inflation. And I think people were saying that the Russian paradigm was just something we had to live with. You just, as I think Jimmy Carter said, we have to get rid of our inordinate fear of communism. The idea you would roll it back or destroy it was just absurd. And in England, everybody thought the unions were the future. There was this word that we heard all the time called peak oil, that we had exhausted our ability to be self-sufficient, that it was no longer going to be possible, and there was more oil pumped out of the ground than was still left in the ground, and we were dependent on these corrupt regimes in the Gulf. So it was really a bleak time, and Reagan came in and sort of, well, everything's going to be okay. We're going to get good GDP. We're going to get, we're going to reduce unemployment. We're going to break the back of inflation. And we're going to make America great. That was his term, actually. It wasn't Trump's. We're going to make America great again was Reagan's term. And we're going to build up the defenses and crack the back of the Soviet Union. Nobody thought that was possible. They thought, like voodoo economics, I think George H.W. Bush called it. And Thatcher was, she was going to send an armada down to fight over what we were told was a worthless piece of rock in the Falkland Islands. It couldn't be done, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think even in the Bush and Obama years, we just were told after the 2008 meltdown that you could never again get 3% GDP. Larry Summers said that. Paul Krugman said the stock market was done for. You couldn't really ever open Anwar. You couldn't build Keystone. You couldn't bomb the crap out of ISIS, as Trump has promised. It was just, you can't do this, you can't do this. You got to stay in the Paris Accord. You got to, you can't get out of the Iran deal. You can't move the embassy to Jerusalem. And these were psychological. They were not based empirically on a reading of the possible political or cultural economic landscape.
All right. So if we turn to President Trump, at this point, Victor, if the end goal is to make America great again, how are we to judge the president's progress so far?
Well, I don't get into, and I don't think anybody should, into whether people like Trump or don't like Trump or whatever you think. Are his escapades worse than LBJ's or not as bad as JFK or worse than Bill Clinton? It's just better just to be empirical again. And so I just look at the situation. We're at a 3.7, 3.2, 3.5, it depends on the quarter, but we've now had 12 months of annualized 3% GDP growth, and we have the lowest peacetime unemployment rate, I think, in 60 years at 3.7, lowest Latino unemployment, lowest Black unemployment, highest consumer confidence. I think we just had the lowest claims per month for joblessness, unemployment benefits, since it was recorded, or at least for 65 years. We are now, and I can't believe this is true, we are the largest oil producer in the world, and we're exporting more oil than we're importing. We are the largest natural gas, and we're the largest coal producer in the world. We still have the largest economy. When we look at the cultural, social issues at home, we're starting to address a lot of things that we were told you couldn't talk about. So we were told that Title IX and sexual harassment and the loss of the First Amendment and due process for students was just something we're going to have to live with. That's been readdressed by Betty DeVos. And as I said earlier, the Iran deal was a prescription to make sure that Iran was nuclear. That's not necessarily going to happen. Nobody thought you could deal with North Korea. Susan Rice just sort of left office and winked and nodded and said they're going to have nuclear weapons. And they may be pointed at the West, and that's just the way it is. ISIS was just the way it is. But there's nothing ever just the way it is. Just the way it is means I'm a political animal, and I don't want to take the necessary steps that are going to make me unpopular and cause a lot of trouble, but need to be taken. And so most politicians just, as Harry Truman said, pass the buck.
So, Victor, if Donald Trump is a one-term president, he's only about 50% of the way through the job. If he's a two-term president, only 25%. In other words, there's a lot of road still ahead of him. So what would you identify as the crucial variables that are going to determine whether, when all is said and done, he will ultimately be judged effective in creating this national turnaround that he set out to accomplish?
Well, he's got about four things he's got to do. He's got to address the debt. We're on a Bush-Obama trajectory, and he's got to stop doubling the debt. Bush doubled the debt, and Obama, of course, made it worse, because when we went from 4 to 8 trillion, then he doubled it again to 16, 17 trillion, but in real trillions, it was much more than Bush had borrowed. And now Trump is on a trajectory to do almost what Obama did. So he's got to stop that, or we're going to be insolvent. He can't campaign on a wall. Whether we like it or not, you're going to have to build a wall, because that's the one thing that will reduce illegal immigration. It'll change the entire optics of immigration. Instead of beefy Border Patrol guys with shades, dogs, barbed wire, and tear gas, we'll just be passive. We'll have a big wall, and if people want to break the law, they're going to have to climb up, and the optics will be they're going to climb up and throw their relatives over the other side. And or if they want to go out, as it is now, they go out in the desert and sometimes they die. They won't be able to do that anymore, and it'll save lives, but more importantly, it'll send the message that we don't have to go into Mexican territory. We don't have to do any of this. So that's very important. It's very important to reestablish deterrence. So just as we've almost had no incidents of hazing or trying to bully American ships in the Straits of Hormuz, we've got to ensure that happens as well in the South China Sea with the Spratly Islands. I think we're making progress, but we're not there yet. And finally, he's trying to reduce this asymmetry. And somebody got up in the morning, I guess, about 10 years ago and told us, it's just fated that you're going to have a $400 billion annual trade surplus with China, 71 with Mexico, 65 with Germany, NAFTA will be asymmetrical, NATO contributions will be asymmetrical, and you're so powerful, and that's your job, you Americans, you just take it. And so what he's saying is, no, NAFTA, NATO contributions, World Trade Organization, China, Germany, European autos, it's going to be symmetrical. And that's going to be very hard to do because of the asymmetry became the normal, and symmetry now becomes the abnormal. The restoration of normality becomes abnormal. It's such a shock. But he's making progress, but we'll see if he can pull it off on trade and commerce and alliances and things like that.
So final question on the topic of decline and renewed greatness. There is a fairly common American faith that while we may be slow sometimes to react to sources of danger or decline, we'll usually end up getting it right. One thinks of that apocryphal Churchill quote that you hear all the time, that Americans can always be trusted to do the right thing once all other possibilities have been exhausted. And this is often invoked as a way of comforting us that we're sort of uniquely resistant to decline. Is that a justified belief, or should we be wary of thinking that we're unique on this front?
No, I think we're unique. I can think of so many topics where that's the truth. Just think of oil in 2006 and 2007 when at that time it was reaching astronomical price levels, $60, $70. And we were told, as I said, peak oil meant we were all done as an exporter of natural gas and oil. But more importantly, we're going to depend it strategically, economically on unsavory allies. People were told us that Russia was the new oil, petrol power. EU soft power was the answer. We were mired in Iraq. And we kind of turned loose American genius. And they went in, and we had property rights in the United States in a way they do not have in most parts of the world. So people had mineral rights. They wanted to make money. And we had a government that was flexible. And the result was in 10 years, we went from dire economic straits as far as energy into a really, really unique position where it's amazing that a country of 340 million with this level of affluence and at this late date in its history becomes sort of a 19th century energy exporter. And that was just simply done by a bunch of people in Texas and North Dakota that were brilliant innovators with fracking and horizontal drilling in a way that they either banned it in Europe or in other places they didn't have the technological know-how or the legal system to allow leasing in the same manner. And same thing with the military. I mean, we thought the military was under in a period of decline after Iraq, and I think it's making enormous strides in missile defense. It's dominant again. I think China is going to have a lot of problems that we never anticipated, whether it's ecological or cultural or economic or social. And so I think we're in a really good position, even though people seem to think otherwise. But it's psychological. What you say you can or can't do is usually groupthink. And it takes people who are not part of the system to look at things by evidence and inductively, rather than just say, oh, you know, the Council on Foreign Relations says this, the Brookings Institution says this, this is what, you know, the Ford Foundation study says, this is what the Congressional Budget says, researchers. And you don't have, I mean, that's not always true. We saw that on 2016 when I think the New York Times said there's three of our top experts say there's 1, 5, and 6% chance that Donald Trump will be elected. And so I think all of our sources of traditional wisdom and establishment fides, whether it's the New York Times or the Washington Post or NBC or ABC or Network News or NPR or PBS, or all these institutions they don't have a very good track record. That's why Donald Trump got elected. And I know it's been chaotic since he's been here, but it's a reaction against this slothful, stasis, ossified, calcified way of thinking that got us into all of these no-win wars and stagnant economy and this identity politics. You know, that's the wave of the future. You have to accept it. Political correct group thing. And so I'm kind of optimistic. I think all of this chaos and turbulence is actually pretty good. It's a catharsis.
All right. You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read Victor's work at Defining Ideas at hoover.org, as well as at victorhanson.com. And if you enjoy the Classicist, please rate the show on iTunes. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senig. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.